On July 13, 1787, the Confederation Congress adopted, on its third reading, the Northwest Ordinance, probably its most famous piece of legislation. The Northwest Ordinance mandated the organization of territorial governments in the western stretches of the United States between the Appalachians and the Mississippi River and north of the Ohio River whenever a district had accumulated 5,000 free male inhabitants of full age. In the process of extending the fundamental principles of civil and religious liberty, the Northwest Ordinance decreed that there shall be neither slavery nor involuntary servitude in the said territory, and thus setting the stage for the conflict which in 1861 would test the viability of a constitution which at that moment was still being debated. 1 year later, on July 2, 1788, the Congress was duly informed that the ninth state needed to ratify the Constitution had duly transmitted to Congress their ratification. It was typical of the history of the Confederation Congress that it now proceeded to tie itself in knots over whether the new Congress under the Constitution should meet in New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Wilmington, or even the inland town of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And it was not until September 14th that the members relented and set New York as the meeting place, and set the first Wednesday in January as the day for each state to appoint presidential electors, and the first Wednesday in February for the electors to assemble and cast their votes for the first president under the new Constitution. All the new operations of the new Congress and government were to begin on the first Wednesday in March 1789. Congress then briefly took an adjournment on October 2nd, an adjournment which seems to have been the signal for almost everybody to leave town. By October 14th, attendance at the sessions of the Confederation Congress dwindled to just two states. After November 1st, the members met only occasionally. And after February 19th, nobody bothered to show up at all, except for the ever-faithful secretary, Charles Thompson. North Carolina and Rhode Island still truculently declined ratification. But few observers expected, once the other states had ratified, that they would hold out for long. North Carolina finally ratified in November 1789. The holdouts in the Rhode Island legislature fought the calling of a ratifying convention until January, when the governor took advantage of the absence at church of one anti-Federalist diehard to cast a tie-breaking vote in favor. The ratifying convention met in South Kingston, Rhode Island, on March 1, 1790. And then, maddeningly, adjourned. Not until the new Congress voted, in exasperation, to embargo all trade with Rhode Island, did the ratifying convention reassemble and vote very stubbornly, 34-32, to ratify the Constitution. No one was more relieved at the final result than George Washington. The infamy of the conduct of Rhode Island outgoes all precedent, Washington wrote, and especially no state or description of men but would blush to be involved in a connection with the paper money junto of that anarchy. But with ratification, Washington relaxed enough to hope that we may, with a kind of grateful and pious exultation, trace the finger of providence through those dark and mysterious events, thereby, in all human probability, laying a lasting foundation for tranquility and happiness, when we had but too much reason to fear that confusion and misery were coming rapidly upon us. James Madison was able to breathe deeply, too. Writing to Thomas Jefferson in Paris, Madison predicted that, notwithstanding the formidable opposition made to the new federal government, There is now both a certainty of its peaceable commencement in March next, and a flattering prospect that it will be administered by men who will give it a fair trial. And Madison fully expected to be one of those men. But Patrick Henry, in a spasm of vengeance, secured the election of two anti-Federalists, Richard Henry Lee and William Grayson, to be Virginia's first two senators, and tried to induce the state legislature to rig the boundaries of Madison's new congressional district to deny him election to the House of Representatives. But Henry's influence really extended no further than the legislature itself. And when Virginia voters went to the polls on February 2nd, Madison was easily elected as a representative from Virginia to the new House of Representatives, beating James Monroe and winning his own home county by a margin of 216-9. What was not up for grabs was the presidency. General Washington will certainly be called to the executive department, Madison informed Jefferson. Washington, of course, would not deign to campaign for election, lest it be construed into a vainglorious desire of pushing myself into notice as a candidate. He refused even to declare whether he would serve if elected. He spoke loftily of presiding over Mount Vernon, like Cincinnatus in retirement, where he planned to enjoy an unclouded evening after the stormy day of life. John Adams, the veteran of the Continental Congress who had spent most of the years between 1778 and 1788 abroad as a diplomat, had just published his lawyer's overview of A Defense of the Constitutions of Government of the United States. And Washington impulsively suggested that Adams, with his extensive knowledge of the interests and resources of this country, might be worth considering as an alternative to himself as president, at least to prevent the election of an anti-Federalist. But nobody was listening. Not even Adams, who, Madison learned, is pledged to support Washington and will probably be the vice president. When the state electors met on February 4th, 1789, all of them cast their first ballot for Washington, a total of 69 votes. Adams was duly elected vice president. John Jay also received a scattering of votes, and even John Rutledge of South Carolina garnered 6. Washington also understood what would probably happen, and even before the electors met, he began organizing affairs at Mount Vernon in anticipation of another long absence. By mid-February, word was in that Your Excellency has every vote for president. Nothing would actually be official until the new Congress assembled on March 4th and staged a formal counting of the electoral votes, but Washington went to work anyway on an acceptance speech, which by the time he had finished stretched out to 73 pages, and even worse, lobbed one attack after another on the adversaries to this Constitution and on the rotten Articles of Confederation and his personal enemies, if I am so unfortunate as to have deserved such a return from any one of my countrymen. When Washington laid the speech before Madison for his comments in February, the horrified Madison persuaded Washington to drop it and instead substitute a much briefer speech of 1,400 words with much more bland vocabulary. And it was this which became George Washington's first inaugural address. Washington also paid a farewell visit to his octogenarian mother, Mary Ball Washington, in Fredericksburg. Washington's relationship with his mother had never been a particularly close one. She had embarrassed him hugely during the Revolution by applying to the Virginia Assembly for a pension on the grounds of destitution. And there had always been a hint of Tory sympathies in her politics. So he referred to the visit in terms which sounded akin to military obligation. As the last act of personal duty, I may ever have it in my power to pay my mother. He was right. She died a few months later. Just when Washington was going to get to deliver his inaugural speech turned out to be an unlooked-for issue. The new Congress assembled for its first session on March 4, 1789. Only to prove shy of a quorum in both houses. Only 8 senators from New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and Georgia were in attendance. And so they adjourned from day to day. When no other senators appeared after a week, the same members resolved to send a circular letter to the absent members requesting their immediate attendance. Even more humiliating, when no one responded, they were forced to send a second letter on March 18th. The stragglers finally began to appear on March 19th, beginning with William Patterson. And finally, on April 6th, a quorum was declared, all of 12 senators. They proceeded at once to drawing up an official tally of the electoral votes in the Senate chamber on April 7th. John Adams took the chair of the Senate on April 21st, politely protesting his inadequacy and praising the election of Washington. If we look over the catalog of the first magistrates of nations, where shall we find one whose commanding talents and virtues, whose overruling good fortune, have so completely united all hearts and voices in his favor? Word of this election was carried personally to Washington's doorstep at Mount Vernon by Charles Thompson on April 14th, one veteran revolutionary informing another veteran revolutionary that the proofs you have given of your patriotism and of your readiness to sacrifice domestic separation and private enjoyments to preserve the liberty and promote the happiness of your country had resulted in Washington's being called to this great, this important office, not only by the unanimous vote of the electors, but by the voice of America. And it really did seem to be the voice of America that was calling Washington to the presidency. Washington left Mount Vernon on April 16th, and at every stop between Alexandria and New York City, he was hailed with crowds, banners, bell ringing, cannon salutes, topped off by a welcoming parade in New York City on April 23rd, and a performance of a Washingtonized version of the British National Anthem, which went something like this. Joy to our native land, let every heart expand, for Washington's at hand, with glory crowned. He took the presidential oath from New York Chancellor Robert Livingston on the second floor balcony of Federal Hall on April 30th. And to the skeptical eye of one newly minted Pennsylvania senator, William McClay, the 57-year-old general looked as though he would have been more comfortable leading a charge against the British than enduring the inaugural ceremony. This great man was agitated and embarrassed more than ever he was by the leveled cannon or pointed musket, McClay wrote. And in delivering his truncated inaugural address, Washington, as McClay described it, trembled, and several times could scarce make out to read his address, though it must be supposed he had often read it before. He put part of the fingers of his left hand into the side of what I think the tailors call the fall of the breeches, changing the paper into his right hand. After some time, he then did the same with some of the fingers of his right hand. No one, of course, had ever been inaugurated as President of the United States, so there was some buzzing in the Senate about the ceremonial proper to be observed on the reception of the President, and what titles shall be annexed to the offices of president and vice president. John Adams, whose interest in pomp and circumstance was, by some people, uncharitably attributed to his 4 years as the first American minister to Great Britain, believed that neither dignity nor authority can be supported in human minds without a splendor and majesty in some degree proportioned to them. And Adams seriously proposed that Washington be addressed as His Highness, or if you will, His Most Benign Highness. Presidents? No, that wasn't a good term, snorted Adams. Presidents only led fire companies or a cricket club, not a great and independent nation. Others suggested addressing Washington as Excellency or Elective Highness, and even His Highness the President of the United States of America and Protector of the Rights of the Same. It took some jockeying from James Madison for Congress finally to agree to address Washington simply as President of the United States and Mr. President. The members of the new Congress were just as uncertain of themselves. The critical William McClay found the New Yorkers pompous people and the Southerners intemperate. And he soon bewailed his status as a bird alone. Even his fellow Pennsylvanians lacked sociability. According to the Constitution's initial apportionment of representation, the House of Representatives was to be composed of 59 representatives. And until North Carolina and Rhode Island ratified the Constitution and chose members of Congress, 22 senators. There were a number of familiar faces here. 8 members of the House of Representatives, including Madison, Abraham Baldwin, Roger Sherman, the oldest member at 68, Elbridge Gerry, despite his refusal to sign the Constitution, Thomas Fitzsimmons, and George Clymer, had been at the Philadelphia Convention the year before. And 12 of the senators, likewise, most notably Robert Morris, Rufus King, and William Patterson. But there were also a number of new faces, not only new to Congress, but new to national political life. William McClay, for one, who had been a surveyor, farmer, and member of the turbulent Pennsylvania Assembly from western Pennsylvania. There was also the hot-tempered 31-year-old Georgian, James Jackson. Judge Adanus Burke, an Irish-born Catholic from South Carolina who had once studied for the priesthood. And Fisher Ames from Dedham, Massachusetts, who had graduated from Harvard at the unlikely age of 16, served in the Revolutionary Militia and the Massachusetts State Ratifying Convention, and had the distinction of beating Samuel Adams and 13 other candidates for his seat in the House of Representatives. Ames was easily the most interesting of the new congressmen. Shays' Rebellion had startled him into political action in 1786, and he laid the blame for Shays squarely on the shoulders of the Articles of Confederation. "While the bands of union are so loose," Ames complained, "we can expect nothing but more Shays-like outbreaks, and in fact, we are no more entitled to the character of a nation than the hordes of vagabond traitors." People readily compared Fisher Ames to Alexander Hamilton. And indeed, Ames lauded Hamilton for his integrity and honor. "No man," Fisher Ames declared, "more promptly discerned truth. No man more clearly displayed it." But Ames lauded George Washington even more. His view of Washington's inaugural address was substantially more reverential than William McClay's. "Time," Ames admitted, "has made havoc upon his face, but that only increased the awe which I brought with me. His aspect, grave, almost to sadness, his modesty, actually shaking, his voice deep, a little tremulous, and so low as to call for close attention, added to the series of objects presented to the mind, and overwhelming it, produced emotions of the most affecting kind upon the members of Congress. I sat entranced. It seemed to me an allegory in which virtue was personified and addressing those whom she would make her votaries. After making all deductions for the delusion of one's fancy in regard to characters, I still think of him with more veneration than for any other person. And then there was James Madison. Denial of a Senate seat had deeply wounded Madison, much as he struggled to conceal it. Fisher Ames drew a shrewd bead on Madison when he wrote that Madison was a man of sense, reading, address, and integrity, who speaks low, and decently as to manner, and no more. His language is very pure, perspicuous, and to the point. But at the same time, Ames observed that Madison was not a little of a Virginian, and thinks that state the land of promise, and is therefore afraid of their state politics and of his popularity there more than I think he should be. Theodore Sedgwick, also from Massachusetts, drew the same conclusion about Madison. No man, in my opinion, in this country has more fair and honorable intentions or more ardently wishes the prosperity of the public. And yet Madison is constantly haunted with the ghost of Patrick Henry. Nevertheless, as Cyrus Griffin, the outgoing president of the Confederation Congress, told Madison as he left, "We consider you as the main pillar of the business." And to that business, Madison now turned. The first part of that business touched on the fundamental reason the new Constitution had been written: revenue. As soon as the House had a quorum and adopted a set of rules, Madison was on his feet to propose the first national import tariffs on rum, wine, coffee, molasses, salt, tobacco, dried fish and tea, plus a variety of targeted tariffs which would favor countries willing to sign commercial treaties with the United States. That, of course, was a smack in the face to the British, who had still not completely fulfilled their obligations under the Treaty of Paris, much less sought any new agreements with the United States. Still, if that triggered a trade war with Britain, so be it. "I have no fears of entering into a commercial warfare with that nation," Madison declared. "If fears are to be entertained, they lay on the other side." But he could not easily wish away the ghost of Patrick Henry. And so on May 4th, Madison gave notice that he intended to bring on the subject of amendments to the Constitution. And by amendments, what he meant was the Bill of Rights Henry and George Mason had clamored for at the Virginia State Ratifying Convention. Madison had been suspicious of calls for amendments, whether at the state ratifying conventions or elsewhere, fearing, as he did, that, at best, paper barriers against the power of a government are usually worthless. And at worst, he was afraid that amendments would become a way of chipping away, piece by piece, the powers the Constitution had won for the national government. He was even less enchanted with the demand for adding amendments in the form of a Bill of Rights. Once it had been agreed by the Constitutional Convention that the Constitution would be a grant of enumerated rather than general powers, the need for a Bill of Rights, which a general grant of powers could not touch, seemed pointless. If the Constitution only granted the national government certain specified powers, there should be no worry about it reaching for powers that the states already secured in their own bills of rights. But he had not been able to convince Virginians of that at the ratifying convention. And their ratification had come with attachments demanding a Bill of Rights. Unless Madison wanted to jeopardize his own political future with Virginia voters and feed more spite to Patrick Henry, he had every reason for changing his mind. Besides this, it occurred to Madison that an express Bill of Rights, coming as a series of amendments to the Constitution, was neither improper, nor altogether useless. Since the great object in view in the Constitution is to limit and qualify the powers of government, it was not irrelevant to build up hedges against the abuse of power. But the power Madison feared was not the power granted by the Constitution to the President or even to Congress. It was the power of lawless actions by the people at large against the majority in favor of the minority. A republic was not, to borrow Fisher Ames's term, a republic was not a Robin Hood society. And so prescriptions in favor of liberty ought to be leveled against that quarter where the greatest danger lies, in neither the executive or legislative departments of government, but in the body of the people, operating by the majority against the minority. What Madison wanted in a Bill of Rights was not so much restraints on the national executive or the national legislature, but on the selfishness of humanity in general, which had shown in Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, and Western Massachusetts that it was ominously capable, in the name of popular democracy or the will of the people, of picking the pockets of the honest and industrious to subsidize the spendthrift and violent. What Madison had in mind were 19 amendments, which he presented to the House of Representatives on June 8, 1789, beginning with a rewriting of the preamble to include an appeal to the natural rights Jefferson had identified in the Declaration of Independence, the enjoyment of life and liberty, with the right of acquiring and using property, and generally of pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. The other amendments that Madison had sketched out would guarantee that the civil rights of none shall be abridged on account of religious belief or worship, nor shall any national religion be established, nor shall the full and equal rights of conscience be in any manner or on any pretext infringed. That the people shall not be deprived or abridged of their right to speak, to write, or to publish their sentiments, and the freedom of the press shall be inviolable. That the people shall not be restrained from peaceably assembling. That the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And in addition, Madison added prohibitions against self-incriminations, against deprivation of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, against all unreasonable searches and seizures, and, to placate the ever-suspicious partisans of the states, a promise that the powers not delegated by this Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively. Oddly, Madison was least successful in persuading his Federalist sympathizers in the House. Madison wanted the amendments inserted into the body of the Constitution at various relevant places. Roger Sherman objected that this would mutilate the Constitution he had signed in Philadelphia, and so he proposed to attach them at the end. Madison wanted swift action. The House vote to send the amendments to a committee promised delay. And even after the committee reported back Madison's amendments in more or less the same form he had submitted them in July, the House then went into a committee of the whole for further wrangling on August 13th. Finally, on August 24th, the House forwarded Madison's Bill of Rights, now recast as 17 separate amendments, but without the alterations to the preamble of the Constitution, to the Senate. The Senate then did its own wrangling until September 14th, condensing the list to 12. And on September 24th, the House approved the Senate's changes. The whole document then had to go out to the states, and they took until March 1st, 1792, to finish their ratifications. Even then, two of the 12 amendments failed of ratification. One of them would finally be ratified as the 27th Amendment to the Constitution only in 1992. So, the Constitution now had a Bill of Rights, a task undertaken largely by the one man, James Madison, who had most vehemently opposed such a bill in the first place.